Today, President Trump visits Lee County, Alabama, where a deadly tornado struck last weekend.
And as he left the White House today, the president weighed in on the nearly four-year prison sentence his former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, received yesterday for tax and bank fraud that was uncovered in the Russia investigation.
I feel very badly for Paul Manafort. I think it's been a very, very tough time for him. But if you notice, both his lawyer, a highly respected man, and a very highly respected judge, the judge said there was no collusion with Russia.
And it's Friday, so it's time for our politics roundtable. Let's bring in Enrique Acevedo. He's a news anchor at Univision. Enrique, good to have you.
Hi, Peter.
And we've got Rick Klein, the political director at ABC News. Rick, it's good to have you as well.
Hey, thank you.
And Rick, let's start with you. The president may be praising this sentence, but a number of federal prosecutors are surprised that Paul Manafort was sentenced to just 4 years in prison instead of the 20 or so that was recommended in federal sentencing guidelines. Here's former prosecutor Kimberly Whaley. Here's what she said today on Morning Edition.
This judge mentioned that Mr. Manafort really, the guidelines were way too high and that he hasn't had kind of a history of criminal activity. So the president could say, listen, I agree with the judge. I'm going to pardon him.
Rick, what do you think? Is that possible?
It is a really striking moment here because I think it's done two things. One is it's highlighted the skepticism that one particular judge at least has toward the Mueller investigation. Whatever it means for Manafort, he's going to be sentenced to more time just next week. So he's almost 70 years old. He's going to spend a good chunk of the rest of his life in jail. But separate from that, I think it's highlighted a real inequity in the sentencing in this country. White collar criminals who tend to be white and upper middle class or upper class tend to serve a lot less time for serious crimes than the often minorities who are convicted of drug crimes. So I think that's part of the debate that it sparked.
And we're hearing more about that today. Enrique, maybe you can weigh in on that. The complaints that the sentencing shows, the inequity in the justice system for people who are convicted of white-collar crime. Is anybody taking up that issue?
I hope so, because you know this is just another expression of something we have been debating for years, the inequality of our justice system and the need to reform that in order to have it work better for everyone, not just minorities. I think this is a very high profile, very visible case, and hopefully it will lead to changes that are badly needed in our justice system.
Could we get you to weigh in on what happened yesterday with this anti-hatred vote in Congress? On the House floor, Florida Democrat Ted Deutch said it shouldn't be so hard for his party to solely condemn anti-Semitism in a resolution after what he called anti-Semitic statements by Minnesota freshman and Democrat Ilhan Omar.
Any attack must be condemned when it's based on hatred. But when a colleague invokes classic anti-Semitic lies three times, then this body must condemn that anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is worthy of being taken seriously on its own.
So what happened was instead, yesterday, late afternoon, the House passed a measure that broadly condemned all forms of hatred, including anti-Semitism, without naming the Congresswoman or singling out her remarks. This suggested that people who support Israel were more loyal to Israel than to the United States. Rick, why was it so hard for Democrats to not broaden out this resolution?
We are seeing a real split in the Democratic Party over generational lines, in part over racial and demographic lines as well, with this new group of freshman Democrats, some of whom have said some inflammatory things about Israel in particular, but about other issues as well. And I think one of the concerns is that Democrats felt like they needed to say something strong, but they were worried about offending some of their younger colleagues. And it's a signal of the growing pains inside the Democratic Party, how uncomfortable they are with some of the people in their ranks now, although by the end of the week, they were all able to get on board for a resolution. It was Republicans, about two dozen of them actually voted against the broader resolution because they felt like it wasn't targeted.
Enrique, here's what I don't fully understand about this situation. Democrats are saying the exact opposite thing that Rick just said. Democrats have made the point all week long that they are not split over this, that there is not a division in the party. But clearly, it looks from this vantage point like they are.
Yeah, you're not alone in this, Peter. I think most of us understand that there is this tension within the party, and not just this issue, but others. Look at climate change with the Green New Deal and what ended up happening with Schumer going out and defending climate change as an important issue for the 2020 campaign, something a few of us would have thought that could happen a few years ago. So it's not just on these issues, other issues that are exhibiting that tension within the party. Mm-hmm. and the generational, transformation that's underway in the Democratic Party.
Okay, here's the president talking about the vote last night, this morning.
The Democrats have become an anti-Israel party. They've become an anti-Jewish party, and that's too bad.
Rick, the president has his own history of making anti-Semitic comments, but you have to believe that the Republicans are watching all of this, knowing that they are going to take full advantage of this split between Democrats.
No doubt. It doesn't help that they were split themselves on the final vote, and it also doesn't help that the president is making a wildly inflammatory remark that just is not accurate. Almost all of the Democrats almost all of the Jewish members of Congress actually are Democrats. There is strong support for Israel and against anti-Semitism in the Democratic Party, notwithstanding comments of some. Mm-hmm. I think it's easy to argue that Republicans have a bigger problem with anti-Semitic members of Congress, like Congressman Steve King and the comments he's made as part of the allegations there, not to mention the Charlottesville rally where anti-Jewish chants, anti-Semitic chants were met with the president saying that there were good people on both sides, something he's still not fully explained. There are Republicans who would love to take political advantage of this, but I think there is a lot of vulnerability for Republicans to take that on, given the president's own comments and mm-hmm. given some elements inside the Republican Party.
And if I may, Peter, I'm sorry, Lisa,
yeah,
you know, I wish that we had the same reaction with the president or any other official speaks about in a specific community in the way that some have about the Jewish community, about Israel. We have a large Hispanic caucus in Congress, and we don't see the same kind of reaction every time the president talks about Mexican immigrants being rapists and criminals and about most immigrants being criminals. What would happen if the president said the most Jewish people here in America are rapists, criminals, or some are good people? We would see a very different reaction from Congress.
And just one note here, all of the top 2020 Democratic presidential candidates defended Congressman Omar's right to criticize Israel. Congresswoman Omar stood next to the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on the Capitol steps this morning. This is just before Democrats passed their first major bill in the new Congress to make it easier to vote, to increase election security and make campaign finance more transparent.
This is a fight we're engaged in. We are not going to end it until we win, and we can save a lot of time by the Senate just agreeing to the for the people agenda. Thank you. Let's hear it for the freshman class.
That's Nancy Pelosi. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called it a power grab engineered to help Democrats win elections. Rick, any chance of this going anywhere?
No, it is not going to pass the Senate. It will be brought up for a vote in the Senate. The Democrats packaged a whole lot of kind of good government proposals with some proposals that are more politically charged, including a requirement that presidential candidates release their tax returns. Hint, hint about who that's about. Also, automatic voter registration, which I think is one concern that Republicans have, that it may lead to voter fraud, that people will be added to the rolls in very large numbers. There's also an element of the bill that's quite controversial, particularly among Republicans, that would provide matching funds to people that fund their campaigns through small dollar donations. It could be a massive cash infusion from taxpayers to candidates. So the Democrats, I think they called it HR1. That has symbolic value. It's kind of the first thing they get done, but it will not be something that becomes a law.
I was just going to say, this is symbolic of where the Democrats are heading into the 2020 election. And you even heard Nancy Pelosi laughing there at the prospect of the Senate picking this up and passing it, Enrique.
Yes, and I think, you know, for Democrats, this is interesting because they can say now in the campaign that they voted for all these bills and they tried to promote all these projects in Congress, and that Republicans were the ones who opposed them. So even if it doesn't go anywhere in Congress, I think they can use this in the election, and it's probably their purpose of it.
Wonder if we can look at 2020, what you both think that it means that Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown announced that he's not running for president. You can also tick off the list New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley. They all said basically count them out. Does this pave the way for former Vice President Joe Biden, who is reportedly 95% sure that he is running? Rick, what do you think?
it opens up a Biden-sized lane in the party, particularly the Bloomberg and then the Sherrod Brown move, which the latter of which really surprised me. He represents a similar working class, middle America spirit of the Democratic Party. Michael Bloomberg, again, kind of a moderate in the party. That is where Biden would essentially position himself, an unapologetic progressive, but also pretty moderate and pretty practical in his disposition. I do think that there's a chance that Democrats see him as the future. It's really up to him, though, whether he feels like that's the case and whether he feels like he's prepared to defend a lot of controversial things in his own past.
Enrique, do you think at this point Democrats, the field is essentially full, just waiting for Biden, and that's essentially it at this point?
It felt like that a couple of weeks ago, and now it's probably even more full. I think, yes, people are waiting for Biden. It's the polls show he's one of the strongest candidates going to the primaries, so even though it is a full field, there is a lane, like Rick says, for someone like Biden. And you know, we can expect that in the next couple of weeks, I think.
And just very quickly, we have almost no time, but what is the number one issue from his past that will come back to be examined pretty closely?
I think the issues around women and the Clarence Thomas hearings, yes, is probably one that crystallizes.
All right. Rick Klein, ABC News political director, and Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. Thanks to you both, as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.